Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, December 21st. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, PSP shows what it can do for region. Editor's note, this is the first of the reports on the top 10 stories of 2022. The Reporter Telegram will run reports through the end of the year, ending with the top story of 2022. This article was written by Stuart Doreen. In 2022, a coalition of Permian Basin energy companies, known as the Permian Strategic Partnership, repeatedly flexed its financial muscle to benefit the Permian Basin. The PSP's efforts impacted workforce development, healthcare, education, and transportation, all priorities of the coalition companies, which individually benefited from prosperous 2022 in America's most significant oil patch. There probably was no greater example of the PSP's ability to impact outcomes in the Permian than a stretch of announcements in April. In a span of less than a week, three announcements happened that showed three different PSP donations totaling $30.3 million to causes in Midland and across the Permian Basin. It started with Midland College's announcement of the construction of a $30 million home for the new Pre-K Academy and Early Childhood Education Program. The PSP, it was announced, was one of two $10 million grants. The Scarborough Foundation would offer the other. The center will be a home to the youngest of students in Midland, and the Early Childhood Education Program will allow for teaching candidates to receive a bachelor's degree in early childhood education and hopefully help build a teaching workforce in the region. Days later, education received another shot in the arm as it was announced that the Permian Strategic Partnership and Centennial Resource Development would team up with the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation to gift science, technology, engineering, and math STEM centers in 134 elementary schools across the region. It is expected that more than 60,000 students and 2,000 teachers in 22 counties would be impacted, it was reported at the time. The PSP's contribution was $7.5 million. Before the end of the month came the announcement of a partnership between Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center and the PSP. A $12.8 million gift will fund a Permian Basin surgical and subspecialty resident training program. The new program will recruit surgical and subspecialty residents to provide general surgery as well as cardiology and gastroenterology in Permian Basin hospitals, it was reported at the time. The hope is to educate surgeons in the Permian who then stay in the region. There were other PSP efforts during 2022, including a partnership with the PSP and America's Warrior Partnership to increase support for the 20,000 veterans across the Permian Basin area, a $10.6 million donation from the Permian Strategic Partnership to the University of Texas Permian Basin that will cover tuition and fees for undergraduates majoring in nursing, pre-med, pre-dental, and pre-pharmacy through a competitive, renewable 4-year scholarship. Again, an investment that officials hope will grow the next generation of healthcare providers in the Permian Basin. Support for a SkillPoint Alliance program, SkillPoint Permian Basin, that will offer rapid training programs in electrical, HVAC, and plumbing, among other trades, to Permian Basin communities in West Texas and Southeast New Mexico. A $3.17 million donation to the Permian Road Safety Coalition to fund life-saving equipment to first responders in 26 counties across West Texas and Southeast New Mexico. This partnership, built upon the first round of this initiative, which was previously funded by the PSP in 2021, with a $1.1 million donation. Playing a lead role in transportation building efforts, working with groups like the Midland-Odessa Transportation Alliance. In the fall, it was announced that the Odessa District of the Texas Department of Transportation is set to receive $3 billion in Unified Transportation Program funding over the next 10 years. The PSP also is working with the Scarborough Foundation and members of both hospital districts in Midland and Odessa on a mental health facility that will be built in Midland-Odessa and on a medical center that could be developed, making Midland-Odessa a healthcare destination. An assessment pointed out that almost 50% of people in Midland-Odessa leave the region for healthcare, specifically for specialty reasons. Officials looking at the long-term program are hoping to build a medical complex that allows more people to stay in Midland-Odessa for healthcare, that creates a regional medical facility that helps in the recruitment of doctors, surgeons, and other medical personnel. This article is entitled, Report: More Teens in Midland Are in Workforce Than U.S. Average, by Ben Schaffer. Midland ranks 128th in small metro areas for the percentage of teens in the labor force, according to a new study by Smartest Dollar. 39.1% of Midland teens are in the labor force, higher than the 38.3% nationwide participation rate. From 1978 through 2011, the national teen labor force participation rate fell from a peak of 59.3% to 33.3%. The COVID-19 pandemic disrupted this trend. As businesses reopened, teens were attractive employees due to low rates of high-risk infections, flexible schedules, and the suspension of in-person after-school activities, the study stated. The study states that 85.9% of Midland teens are enrolled in school, and 5.5% are not in school or the labor force. Texas reports 34.3% of teens are in the labor force, which ranks the state 44th out of 50. This article is entitled, Mission Agape Gives Out Books, Gifts During Christmas Blessing. Diamondback Energy Reps Hand Out Books in English, Spanish, by Mercedes Cordero. Mission families attended the Mission Agape's Christmas Blessing event at Golf Course Road Church of Christ on Saturday. Attendees were able to select age-appropriate gifts for their children from tables lined with hundreds of items. The event served 260 families, representing more than 800 children. Mission Agape's Christmas Blessing is in partnership with Diamondback Energy and the Literacy Coalition. Representatives from Diamondback Energy were present, giving away books in both English and Spanish. The support of our community is what makes this happen, Stacy Backus, Executive Director and founder of Mission Agape, said. The partnership with Diamondback resulted in the distribution of more than 3,000 books around the Permian Basin, according to John Trichetti III, Executive Director of the Literacy Coalition. The impact is so much broader when you can partner with Diamondback to get books into the hands of kids, Trichetti said. Diamondback Energy is proud to partner again with the Literacy Coalition of the Permian Basin to provide books for children in English and Spanish during this holiday season, Clint Williamson said. Books have the power to reach their imaginations. We wish everyone peace this holiday season. This article is entitled, Mission Agape Focuses on Region's Food Insecurity, by Russ Hale, Mission Agape. Editor's note, this article from Mission Agape is another in the series from a local nonprofit highlighting its service during the giving season. If your organization has a message to send out to Reporter Telegram readers during the month of December, please send it to sdoreen@hearstnp.com. For 10 years, Mission Agape has demonstrated God's love in action in an effort to end food insecurity in the Permian Basin. Mission Agape began in 2012 by providing weekend food bags to 20 elementary students. To say the ministry has grown is an understatement. Currently, 250 volunteers serve each month. 2,400 children who are referred through MISD and community in schools receive weekend food bags each week. 50 to 60 families receive food boxes each month at our food pantry. Volunteers deliver food boxes to 530 families in rural West Texas communities each month. 1,100 students received backpacks and school supplies at the start of the school year. 200 families were given a Thanksgiving meal box and a gift card to purchase a turkey. And over 700 children received new toys and clothing at our Christmas Blessings event. We feel privileged that we have been able to serve more and more children and families who are experiencing food insecurity. We are currently working out of a 1,500-square-foot building, which is generously loaned to us. However, our current location will no longer allow us to meet these increasing needs. We are excited to announce the launch of the Unity in the Community campaign, a $3.8 million initiative to fund the construction of a 7,700-square-foot distribution center. This new facility will allow Mission Agape to serve more children and families who are experiencing hunger, receive semi-truck deliveries from food manufacturers, dramatically lowering food costs, store 3 to 6 months of food reserves so that supply chain problems are lessened, consolidate our operations in a professional administrative facility, and host volunteer groups and community events in collaborative workspaces. We need your help. Would you consider supporting this ministry by giving a 2-year pledge to the building campaign? Or could you give a one-time or monthly donation to our general operations? Please go to missionagape.org/mission-agape-donate to learn more about the Unity in the Community initiative and see the vision for our new facility. Questions? Please email us at sbacchus@missionagapewtx.org. This article is entitled, Dangerously Cold Weather is on Its Way to Midland. Front to push low temperature on Thursday night into Friday morning to 7 degrees, by Stuart Doreen. Dangerously cold weather is headed to the region, according to the National Weather Service. The NWS is reporting an Arctic front will move into the region on Thursday morning, causing an extreme temperature gradient. The front will push the low temperature on Thursday night into Friday morning to 7 degrees. That rush of cold air is likely to mean breezy conditions that will make it feel like below 0 degrees to well below 0 degrees across the region, the NWS reported. Wind chills will be as low as 5 to 15 degrees below zero Friday morning due to low temperatures and breezy conditions in the wake of Thursday's cold front, the NWS reported on its website. Saturday morning will see wind chills in the single digits. These values are dangerously low, so be sure to limit time outdoors and dress in multiple layers. The road to the coldest temperature since February 4th, also 7 degrees, starts with a low near 28 degrees on Wednesday night, and then patchy blowing dust on Thursday. Winds could gust as high as 35 miles an hour, and the high temperature is expected to reach 34 degrees, or barely above freezing. Following the 7-degree low temperature on Thursday night, Friday morning, the NWS is calling for a high temperature of 24 Friday, and a low temperature of 14. Frostbite and hypothermia will be main concerns for anyone working outside for a prolonged period of time, the NWS reported. By comparison, the NWS reported wind chilled values of minus 40 in the oil fields of North Dakota this week. Christmas Eve night, Midlanders can expect a low temperature of 21 degrees. On Christmas, warmer conditions will prevail, with a high of 50 and a low of 30, according to the NWS. there is no precipitation predicted in the next 7 days. This article is entitled, Midland Police Search for Suspect in West Midland Double Homicide, by Mercedes Cordero. Midland Crime Stoppers is offering a cash reward for any information that helps a double homicide that took place on Saturday. Midland Police Department officers were dispatched Saturday at about 1:26 a.m. to the Ranch of Midland Apartments located at 4315 Neely Avenue in reference to shots fired. Officers found two gunshot victims identified as 20-year-old female Anjaya Sadler and 22-year-old male DeCameron Sims inside an apartment deceased. Officers on the scene were notified that a third gunshot victim, a 21-year-old male, drove himself to the hospital, according to a previous Reporter Telegram report. Limited information was gathered during the investigation, but it is believed that the shooter was wearing all black and had on a dark ski mask covering his face, according to a Midland Crime Stoppers Facebook post. If a person has information about the case, call the hotline. Go to 694tips.com or use the mobile app P3TIPS. A person could earn a $1,000 cash reward if the tip leads to his arrest. No caller ID is used, and callers will remain anonymous. Reference MPD case 221-217-003. This article is entitled DPS. Andrews woman dies in crash on U.S. 385, by Mercedes Cordero. A 37-year-old Andrews woman died Monday after a two-vehicle collision on U.S. Highway 385 in Andrews County, according to the Department of Public Safety. DPS reported that a 2004 Buick LeSabre was traveling westbound on Southeast County Road 1500 and attempted to cross both southbound lanes of U.S. Highway 385. The driver failed to yield the right-of-way to a Ford F-150 traveling southbound on U.S. Highway 385 and was struck on the passenger side, according to DPS. The passenger of the Buick LeSabre, Misty Dawn Dorries, was transported to Permian Regional Medical Center in Andrews, where she was pronounced deceased by medical staff. The driver of the 2004 Buick LeSabre was transported to Medical Center Hospital in Odessa and was reported to be in stable condition. The driver of the Ford F-150 was treated at Permian Regional Medical Center for minor injuries. Dorries was not wearing a seatbelt, according to DPS. The accident took place around 5:02 p.m. Monday. This is the obituary column. Wednesday, December 21st. Betty Lindell Phillips Cook. Betty Lindell Phillips Cook died in Midland on December 17th after a long life, diverse and well spent. The only child of early Houstonians Carl Phillips and Ruby Applegate Phillips, Betty was born in Mart, Texas on June 22nd, 1927. She is survived by children Lindy and Jim Severns of Fort Davis, Kathy and Fatty Namor of Vancouver, Canada, Kelly and Carol Cook of Midland, 6 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. Private services will be held in Mart, Texas at a later date. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that you make donations online or through the mail to Midland Children's Rehabilitation Center, 802 Ventura Avenue, Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Christy McCabe. Christy McCabe, age 68, of Midland, passed away December 18th. Christy was preceded in death by her parents, Inez and Charles Cook, and eldest son, Charlie McCabe. Christy is survived by 2 sons, Michael and Nicholas McCabe, as well as 5 grandchildren. A memorial service will be held in her honor at 11 a.m. on Friday, December 23rd, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Margie M. Rowe. Margie M. Rowe, age 88, of Midland, passed away on December 16th. Public visitation, Wednesday, December 21st, from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home. Funeral service, Wednesday, December 21st, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home. Burial, Wednesday, December 21st, at 12 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park.
This is Thoris with the Odessa American News for Wednesday, December the 21st. The headline is One Dead Teen, One Hospitalized Following Shooting. The Ector County Sheriff's Office is investigating after a 19-year-old Odessa man was shot to death Monday night and a 16-year-old boy with gunshot wounds was dropped off at Odessa Regional Medical Center by an unknown female. During a press conference Tuesday, Sheriff Mike Griffiths said it appears as though Jeremiah Nathaniel Padilla was at his residence in the 13,000th block of Firewater Trail when he went outside to greet a pickup truck around 6 p.m. There apparently was a communication, a conversation that transpired, and at some point, somebody pulled a gun and shots were fired, Griffiths said. Padilla was taken to Medical Center Hospital, where he succumbed to his injuries, and an unnamed 16-year-old who was in the pickup truck was taken to Odessa Regional Medical Center by an unknown female, Griffiths said. The teenager is not in a condition where he can talk to us, Griffiths said. Hopefully, if he gets in a condition where he can talk to us, he will. We sure would like to talk to him, but there's a good chance he won't. The boy is not under guard, and investigators are waiting for hospital staff to alert them if he becomes conscious and alert, Griffiths said. There was a large gathering at the house at the time of the shooting, but there was only one juvenile witness to the fatal shooting, and his story has not yet been corroborated. Detectives have found the pickup truck, and crime scene technicians are processing it for evidence, but they did find shell casings from two-caliber weapons at the scene and inside the truck, Griffiths said. The witness said a girl was in the pickup truck with a 16-year-old, but it's unclear if she was the one who dropped him off at the hospital, Griffiths said. It is also unclear if there were additional people in the truck and who among them fired the rounds that killed Padilla, he said. The individual who dropped the subject off did not hang around, and we're vigorously trying to find that individual right now, Griffiths said. We have very little to go on right now. It is a female. The sheriff said he is concerned that over the last few years, the ages of shooting victims and suspects have been increasingly getting lower. Interim city attorney sanctioned last year. Judge found Jones acted in bad faith, sought harassment. The city of Odessa's interim city manager and interim city attorney have routinely exceeded expectations on their annual reviews in recent years, but interim city attorney Dan Jones was told his job was in jeopardy late last year after he was sanctioned by an Ector County District Court judge and exposed the city to legal action in other instances. Jones, a senior assistant city attorney, was named interim city attorney Tuesday after the Odessa City Council voted 5-2 to fire city attorney Natasha Brooks. They named Billings and Collections Director Agapito Bernal the interim city manager after firing Michael Mariro. The Odessa American asked for disciplinary records, and the last three evaluations for Brooks, Mariro, Jones, and Bernal through the Texas Public Information Act. The city said it does not conduct written evaluations of its city manager and city attorney. The Human Resource Department found no disciplinary records for Brooks or Mariro. The five council members who voted to fire them have not voiced their reasoning for the terminations, nor have four of them responded to repeated requests for interviews. City Secretary Norma Aguilar Grimaldo set up a January 9th interview for Mayor Javier Hoven, stating that was his earliest availability as he's going out of town. Hoven was seen bell ringing for the Salvation Army Tuesday afternoon. Jones, who obtained his law degree from the University of Mississippi School of Law, was hired as a senior assistant attorney in early 2019. Prior to that, he spent 2.5 years as a defense and personal injury attorney in Jackson, Mississippi, 5 years as the district attorney in Mendenhall, Mississippi, and 10 years in private practice in Mendenhall. In that role, he acted as the municipal attorney for two towns, the juvenile public defender and school board attorney. According to Ector County court records, Jones was representing the city of Odessa in a car accident lawsuit last year when Judge James Rush of the 244th District Court agreed to sanction Jones on the request of the plaintiff's attorneys. Rush found that Jones filed a frivolous motion, signed pleadings that were groundless and brought in bad faith, and contained unstoppable factual and legal allegations, and he filed a motion for the purpose of harassment and interposed for the improper purpose of causing needless increase in the cost of litigation. The judge further found Jones failed to make a reasonable inquiry into whether the city's garbage truck driver was within the course and scope of his employment at the time of the crash, even though the crash happened 2 years before the city responded to the lawsuit. When Jones found out the man was working at the time of the crash, Rush said the city and Jones still refused to drop their motion to dismiss the lawsuit to the detriment of the prompt and proper administration of justice, court documents state. The judge wrote in his order, he found Jones's explanations were non-persuasive and lacked merit. The judge ordered the city to pay the plaintiff attorney for the more than 23 hours she spent on her motion for sanctions at a cost of $300 an hour. The city was ordered to pay $5,000, and Jones was ordered to pay $2,050. This court has the highest expectation that the city and its attorneys will read, learn, and apply the provisions of the Texas Disciplinary Rule of Professional Conduct, the Texas Lawyer's Creed, the aforementioned provisions of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 13, prior to making any further appearances in court, Rush wrote. Ultimately, the lawsuit was settled. On October the 22nd, 2021, Brooks issued Jones a written warning, warning him in bold that his job was in jeopardy. According to the warning, Brooks told Jones he'd been told by her not to appear in Rush's courtroom for the hearing to discuss whether he and the city should be sanctioned, and as a result of your appearance, the city and Jones were sanctioned. Odessa man killed while walking along roadway. A 31-year-old man was arrested Tuesday morning on suspicion of criminal negligent homicide after police said he struck and killed a pedestrian. According to the Odessa Police Department, authorities believe David Wheatley, 36, was walking north on the eastbound shoulder of West County Road when Arturo Soros struck him by going onto the shoulder in a Chevy Avalanche to pass other vehicles in the 7200 block. Texas oil, natural gas industry outlines weather preparedness. As Texans prepare for the coming cold weather, operators in the Texas oil and natural gas industry are also preparing for the freezing temperatures that are expected for much of the state later this week and into this weekend. According to the U.S. National Weather Service, a polar air mass will push south through the central U.S. plains and down into Texas on Wednesday night into Thursday morning, and temperatures will fall to below freezing behind the front, bringing the coldest temperatures this season thus far, a news release said. In the Permian Basin region, the Arctic front is expected to bring new December lows. On Thursday night and Friday morning, temperatures forecasted for Midland will be in the low teens, according to the U.S. National Weather Service. Friday's forecast includes highs in the mid-20s and lows in the lower teens. These low temperatures are expected to rise above freezing by Saturday afternoon and into the 50s by Christmas Day, the release said. If the power stays on to oil and natural gas production and transmission systems, some impact to production will likely occur, but will not be to the severity experienced during Winter Storm Uri. Following action by the Texas legislature, the Railroad Commission of Texas mandated critical load designation for the most critical natural gas assets and related systems, and starting December 1st, operators with facilities that are required to weatherize must also share their emergency preparedness plans with the RRC, including considerations for how each operator will protect their employees, the environment, and their equipment when implementing their plans. Requirements extend to external support operations, such as water disposal wells, a necessary function to continue oil and natural gas production. Oil and natural gas operators have extensive resources in place to monitor and prepare for inclement weather on an ongoing basis and utilize best practices and operational plans in order to maximize product flow. On site, seasonal weatherization techniques include methanol injection temperature activated pumps, steamer units, equipment shelters, and insulated critical lines and valves. Additional pre-storm and off-site measures also prepare operators to better respond during inclement weather to ensure assets and personnel are safe and able to respond to critical needs. Examples of additional measures include secure shelter/housing and pre-positioning personnel to be closer to assets for access. Adjusting employee schedules to ensure planning and preparations in place. Having extra methanol and other supplies on trucks. Preparing and draining tanks to increase on-site storage and provide a temporary buffer for necessary third-party movement of product. Pre-inspection of assets prior to weather event. Line packing to maximize product and pressurization in pipelines. Communication with third-party vendors to prepare for inclement weather contingencies. Identification of the most critical assets to help maintain power from electric utilities. Even with these winterization techniques in place, production fluctuations are expected during extreme weather conditions. Variation in daily natural gas production occurs with sudden temperature changes because these are field operations, not controlled factory settings. According to the RRC, even on mild weather days, daily natural gas production can fluctuate for a variety of reasons. Prudent users of natural gas, domestically and globally, plan on backup fuel sources for contract for firm storage and supply to meet their needs during production decline periods, the release said. Texas is more fortunate than most states due to our vast natural gas shortage infrastructure. During significant weather events and expected production declines, daily production combined with natural gas shortage provides ample access to product for power generation and local distribution companies that have contracted for these services. Texas typically produces/markets about 29 BCF/D of natural gas, and natural gas used for electricity generation is typically only about 5 PCF/D. Texas has 544 BCF of working natural gas shortage capacity, enough to power 5 PCF/D of power generation for approximately 109 days. Peak electricity demand is expected to occur on Friday morning between 7 and 9 a.m. Power generators with firm contracts for supply, storage, and transmission for the volumes they need during extreme weather prove more reliable and resilient. All sectors of the Texas oil and natural gas industry take steps to prepare for weather events in order to ensure the production and transportation of energy can continue even in the most extreme conditions. Earthquake wells draw more scrutiny. Most saltwater disposal well injections had been curtailed before Friday's big quake, having required lesser volumes of produced water and shallower depths of injections a year ago. The Texas Railroad Commission is mulling further action against the operators of the saltwater disposal wells 12 miles north of Midland that apparently caused the humongous earthquake that shook the bejabbers out of region last Friday as far distant as Crane and Seminole. An RRC spokesman said Monday that wells within 2.5 miles of the earthquake's epicenter were inspected Saturday. We continue to compile and analyze data on Friday's 5.4 magnitude earthquake as the agency works on an action plan for the Gardendale Seismic Response Area, spokesman Andrew Keese said. We will let you know when further updates occur. With regard to RRC's action to indefinitely suspend deep disposal in the Gardendale SRA in December 2021, it was expected that it could take a year or more for the frequency and magnitude of seismic in the area to be reduced. Between December the 17th, 2021, and December the 15th, 2022, we noted significant reductions. All deep wells are no longer injecting. A list of deep disposal wells in the RRC's December 2021 action for the SRA is available via the RRC's seismicity response page at https://www.rrc.texas.gov/oil-and-gas/applications-and-permits/injection-storage-permits/oil-and-gas-waste-disposal/injection-disposal-permit-procedures-and-seismicity-review/seismicity-response/Aaron Kregis, K-R-E-J-C-I. A spokesman for Railroad Commissioner John Wright said the problem is an ongoing complex issue. As Commission staff has previously stated, there is a lag time between changes in injection rates and changes in seismicity, which, based on information from seismic experts and previous activity of this nature, can be anywhere from 12 to 18 months or more. The Commission is continuously evaluating the efficacy of our seismic response and updating and modifying those efforts as the situation dictates or new data becomes available. Maps and more information about the earthquakes are on websites maintained by the Oil and Natural Gas Regulating Railroad Commission and the University of Texas Affiliated Bureau of Economic Geology at gis.rrc.texas.gov/GISVIEWER and injection.texnet.beg.utexas.edu. The maps show companies running 30 SWD wells in the GSRA, most of the companies cited by the Railroad Commission last year as having earthquake-causing wells, began injecting lesser amounts at shallower depths as requested. However, Wasser and Crown Quest continued as before in defiance of their appeals being rejected at an RRC hearing early this year. Neither Greg Mabee, Chief Executive Officer of Wasser, nor Tim Dunn, CEO of Crown Quest, responded to requests for comment Monday. Registering 5.4 in magnitude on the Richter scale at 5:35 p.m. Friday, Texas's fourth most powerful earthquake in history, was quickly followed by quakes registering 2.7 and 3.3. Without mentioning any companies, Keese noted Saturday that the agency had ordered the indefinite suspension of all GSRA deep injection produced water disposal wells in December 2021, adding that now that the RRC will review permit requirements for other injection wells in the area as it prepares for a response to reduce the frequency and intensity of earthquakes. Produced water is the briny, chemical-laden water that's used in the fracturing or fracking of oil shale formations. Earthquake wells draw more scrutiny. Most saltwater disposal well injections had been curtailed before Friday's big quake, having required lesser volumes of produced water and shallower depths of injections a year ago. The Texas Railroad Commission is mulling further action against the operators of the saltwater disposal wells 12 miles north of Midland that apparently caused the humongous earthquake that shook the bejabbers out of region last Friday, as far distant as Crane and Seminole. An RRC spokesman said Monday that wells within 2.5 miles of the earthquake's epicenter were inspected Saturday. We continued to compile and analyze data on Friday's 5.4 magnitude earthquake as the agency works on an action plan for the Gardendale Seismic Response Area, spokesman Andrew Keese said. We will let you know when further updates occur. With regard to RRC's action to indefinitely suspend deep disposal in the Gardendale SRA in December 2021, it was expected that it could take a year or more for the frequency and magnitude of seismic in the area to be reduced. Between December 17, 2021 and December 15, 2022, we noted significant reductions. All deep wells are no longer injecting. A list of deep disposal wells in the RRC's December 2021 action for the SRA is available via the RRC's seismicity response page at https://www.rrc.texas.gov/oil-gas/applications-and-permits/injection-storage-permits/oil-and-gas-waste-disposal/injection-disposal-permit-procedures-and-seismicity-review/seismicity-response/Aaron Kregis, K-R-E-J-C-I. A spokesman for Railroad Commissioner John Wright said the problem is an ongoing complex issue. As commission staff has previously stated, there is a lag time between changes in injection rates and changes in seismicity, which, based on information from seismic experts and previous activity of this nature, can be anywhere from 12 to 18 months or more. The commission is continuously evaluating the efficacy of our seismic response and updating and modifying those efforts as the situation dictates or new data becomes available. Maps and more information about the earthquakes are on websites maintained by the Oil and Natural Gas Regulating Railroad Commission and the University of Texas Affiliated Bureau of Economic Geology at gis.rrc.texas.gov/gisvieweer and injection.texnet.beg.utexas.edu. The maps show companies running 30 SWD wells in the GSRA, most of the companies cited by the Railroad Commission last year as having earthquake-causing wells, began injecting lesser amounts at shallower depths as requested. However, Wasser and Crown Quest continued as before in defiance of their appeals being rejected at an RRC hearing early this year. Neither Greg Mabee, Chief Executive Officer of Wasser, nor Tim Dunn, CEO of CrownQuest, responded to requests for comment Monday. Registering 5.4 in magnitude on the Richter scale at 5:35 p.m. Friday, Texas's fourth most powerful earthquake in history was quickly followed by quakes registering 2.7 and 3.3. Without mentioning any companies, Keese noted Saturday that the agency had ordered the indefinite suspension of all GSRA deep injection produced water disposal wells in December 2021, adding that now that the RRC will review permit requirements for other injection wells in the area as it prepares for a response to reduce the frequency and intensity of earthquakes. Produced water is the briny, chemical-laden water that's used in the fracturing or fracking of oil shale formations. Burger Barn donates gifts to Youth Center. Burger Barn co-owners Afrika and Tiffany Norman donated 25 gift bags to the juveniles at the Ector County Youth Center. The gift bags included the book Concrete Rose by Angie Thomas, and it also had chips, cookies, and candies. Tiffany Norman said she wanted to make the juveniles at the Ector County Youth Center feel not forgotten during the holidays. "We want to make sure that these kids aren't forgotten about and that someone still cares," she said. "Just because they might have gotten themselves into some trouble or be in a bad situation, that we wanted to give them some hope. We choose to give them a book that could really speak to them." Ector County Youth Center Facility Administrator Albert Aguirre said this was the first time in the 12 years there that someone donated gift bags during the holidays. He said he had to get approval for the items that would be in the gift bags. Aguirre said he knows that juveniles will be appreciative of the gifts. "I've been here going on 12 years, and we've had people donate food, but as far as gift bags, we haven't had that before," he said. "We do have a lot of kids that like to read back there. A lot of kids do ask for new books, so they are going to be very grateful for that." Norman said the spark behind wanting to donate gift bags came after she saw a Facebook post from one of the juvenile officers. The Burger Barn, which is located at 5984 North Seward Avenue, donated 50 plates for Thanksgiving. Norman said she wants to make this holiday gift giving a continued tradition. "We like to continue to do this every year," she said. "It's the same thing with our Thanksgiving give back." Odessa American Obituaries. Kelly Lee Autry, 71, of Odessa, died Wednesday, December the 14th, in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. December the 21st at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Valentin J.R. Carrasco, 41, of Midland, died Wednesday, December the 14th, in Martin, Colorado. Graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. December the 22nd at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Connie Earlene Clark, 91, of Odessa, died Saturday, December the 17th, in Odessa. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m. December the 22nd at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Catherine Sue Casey Cole, daughter, sister, mother, Girl Scout, paralegal, chief deputy district clerk for Ector County. Dana Ruth Irwin, age 78, of Odessa, died Friday, December the 16th, in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. December the 21st at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Sheldon Marks Hamilton, age 75, of Odessa, died Friday, December the 9th, in Odessa. Terry Blaine Allen, age 53, passed away on December the 17th after a valiant battle with cancer at his home in Odessa. Carol Clay died Saturday, December the 17th, at the age of 81, in Midland. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home. Mary Nell Hurst, age 91, passed away on December the 14th in Midland. Services are pending with American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home. Juanita Jackson McDaniel, 90, of Odessa, died Friday, December the 16th, in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday, December the 21st, at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Barbara Elaine Harris died December the 12th in Odessa. Gregoria Ulate passed away on December the 8th. Weldon Dean Evans, age 67, of Odessa, passed away on Thursday, December the 8th. Mario Rodriguez Hinojos died Tuesday, December the 13th, at the age of 54. Marlon Duane Honol, age 61, of Odessa, passed away on December the 13th.
Taking responsibility. Bowie starts student leader program. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Encouraging students to take responsibility for their campus, Bowie Middle School health and PE coach T.C. Hughes has recruited morning traffic directors. On the average, about 13 students turn up to direct traffic during drop-off in the mornings. There have been a variety of benefits so far, including students showing up to school on time, taking ownership of their campus, and learning about accountability. Quote, "We started a volunteer-based program. They were more than happy, as you see, to come out and lead and take ownership and take accountability for their schooling. So far, it's been a good program, not just to do traffic control, but behind traffic control, teach them, again, accountability, ownership, leadership, confidence, how to speak to adults, as well as work with one another," Hughes said. the student leaders have been conducting traffic direction for close to a month. Other students have tried to join because they see it's a cool thing to do. Quote, "We have a good rotation system. Boys and young ladies are doing it," Hughes said. He added that next semester, he plans to introduce more volunteer-based and student-led programs to take the campus from being classroom and teacher-centered to student-centered. "With those responsibilities, they'll get more rewards," Hughes said. They have only been directing traffic in the morning, so when parents return in the afternoon, they wonder where the student leaders are because, quote, "they do such a good job at getting the cars in and getting the cars out," he said. Aaron Cortez, a 13-year-old eighth grader, said it's good for people to do this because there is usually a lot of traffic and students were getting to school late. Quote, "Since we've been doing this, kids have been arriving here on time, and that's good for Bowie. I like it so far with Coach Hughes," Cortez said. "Helping out makes him feel good because I like the way it's going and I just like it." Cortez added that it has helped him with responsibility and making him get his work done on time. Hughes said he thinks people are coming to school on time because it's kind of like a pep rally with the cars coming through. The students like seeing each other as well. The parents also love what they see. Quote, "It just makes that early morning spirit a little bit better. That goes not just outside of the school, but inside," Hughes said. In addition to the Student Leader Initiative, Hughes said they are going to partner with Keep Odessa Beautiful to bring recycling bins to campus and do some beautification projects. One of Hughes' classes was having a Yes We Can food drive. Their goal was 365 cans, but they've collected some 900 cans, according to a social media post. "We partnered with the West Texas Food Bank and we're feeding families for the holidays. Again, just teaching kids the emotional, social, mental, and physical wellness, and that they can, even now at their age, make a difference in the world, not just for tomorrow, but for today," Hughes said. Hughes, who is from Dallas, has been with ECISD for 2 years. He saw a great opportunity here and decided to stay because of things like student leaders. "The idea is to give young people who haven't necessarily had a chance to become leaders." Joe Angel Mendez, a 14-year-old eighth grader, said he thinks being part of student leaders is pretty cool. Quote, "It's pretty fun to be part of it," Angel said. He added that a lot of his friends joined. "It shows a lot of responsibility and leadership to do this stuff, so I kind of wanted to come in," Angel said. He added that the program has instilled pride and responsibility for the campus. Angel said he would recommend that students get involved in their school. Quote, "It really does help," he added. Hughes said he has been in education for 12 years. Quote, "I started when I was in Dallas actually doing out-of-school, in-school programming. Again, taking schools or campuses that has such programs as RISE, going in truly helping the kids make over their lives and reintroducing them to how they should think, and through that thinking, that neuroplasticity-based model of asset education, allow them to reimagine what life is through the lens of education, through the lens of purpose, and again through the lens of leadership. By combining all of those aspects of it, we've been able to make the kids better," Hughes said. Bowie is a RISE school. RISE stands for Rapidly Improving School Effectiveness Program. It is an initiative geared to bolster academic performance through efforts far beyond those regularly offered. What they focus on strategic staffing and student support, the RISE program identifies specific staff members who can best meet the individual needs of students at participating campuses and then carries out a series of unique action steps to ensure that students' academic, social, and emotional needs are met, the district website says.
This is the Dear Abby column. Woman still gets the cold shoulder from stepdaughter. Dear Abby, I've been married 6 years, and ever since we've been married, my husband's daughter has insisted that I can't come to her house that my husband has a mortgage on. I think he should tell her that if his wife isn't welcome, then he isn't. My husband is 19 years older than I am and has health issues. I am there for him and take care of him, and I'm hurt that he doesn't speak up for me. I feel his daughter should want us to come over together for the sake of her dad. The time is coming when she and the rest of his family will have to come to our house to see him. I don't know if I would be so willing to let them, since they don't want me being part of their family. I have talked to my husband about this, and I'm getting nowhere. He now has dementia. He forgets quite a bit, and he insists it's me and not his daughter who says I'm not welcome. I'm at my wit's end. What do you think about this? Signed, Mift in the Midwest. Dear Mift, I think there may be some relevant facts you didn't include in your letter. Does your husband's daughter resent you because of the difference in your ages? Did you have anything to do with the breakup of his first marriage? When you wrote, they don't want you to be part of the family, exactly to whom were you referring? Frankly, if I were in your shoes, the last thing I would want to do is force my way into a home where I wasn't wanted. I wouldn't be comfortable under those circumstances, and I'm having trouble understanding why you would be. If the time comes when your husband becomes too incapacitated to visit his daughter and the rest of the family, please take the high road and do the compassionate thing. Invite them in so they can be of comfort to your husband. If there is any way to fire up the peace pipe, that is the way to do it. P.S. Because your husband holds the mortgage on his daughter's home, I hope he has consulted an attorney and put his wishes regarding estate planning in writing. Dear Abby, I am a new mom who is fortunate to be able to breastfeed. We've had several guests come to our house to meet the baby, and if she needs to nurse, I go to the couch and allow her to breastfeed. I don't feel the need to hide in another room in my own house when I'm comfortable on my couch with all my necessary pillows to assist. My sister wanted to bring her new boyfriend over to meet my husband, the baby, and me. Before they came, she called to ask me to refrain from whipping out my boobs in front of her new beau. I don't view breastfeeding as flashing, but she prioritized his comfort over mine in my own house. I don't mind using a cover to shield people from seeing my chest, but was her request valid, and should I go into another room in my own home? Signed, Feeding in the West. Dear Feeding, most people are aware that breastfeeding is a natural function. If Sis is uncomfortable with the idea of her new boyfriend seeing you breastfeed, the two of them should excuse themselves and go to another room, or choose a time to visit between feedings. You can write to Dear Abby at dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069. Her column is distributed by Universal Press Syndicate.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.